many of the most meaningful reforms don't require any money. They're about day-to-day things. They're about small ideas that come from inside. They're about changing culture.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. How would you advise the head of a civil service to go about designing and implementing reforms to improve the performance of that civil service? Well, that question is at the start and is the central theme of a new book called Reform as Process. The author is Martin Williams, who conducted research alongside Ghana's civil service for more than a decade. He's currently at the University of Michigan. And it's a question he attempted to answer from the inside. And he joins me today to talk about what he learned, both from his experience and from talking to others who have also struggled with the same task. Martin, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, Tim.
Martin, tell me about the moment you were asked that question.
Back in 2014, I was coming towards the end of my PhD research, during which I had been partnering with the civil service in Ghana to conduct research on questions related to organizational performance and policy implementation. In 2014, there was a new head of civil service appointed, Nana Adjikumjamina. And I remember a meeting that we had in his office where he said to me, Martin, I've just been appointed. I've got 5 years and I want to change the way that this place works and improve its performance. What's the evidence on how I should go about that? What do you academics and researchers have to tell us who are in government about how to reform these kind of bureaucracies that we work in? And I thought that that was a totally reasonable question to ask an academic like me who was studying bureaucratic performance. But to be honest, I was really disappointed in the answer that I was able to give at the time. It's the type of question that I think most academics don't ask because it's too big, it's too hard, it's too messy to answer. So that conversation launched two different streams of research. One stream of research was a series of kind of more conventional economics, micro-level journal articles, which was based on some really intensive data collection and analysis, surveys and interviews and a randomized control trial. And that was work that was done with the Office of the Head of the Civil Service in Ghana, and also with other co-authors, including Dan Roger, Imran Rasool, Leah Yakalotekla, Margarita Fornasari. And that set of research looked at things like the impacts of specific management practices on organizational performance, barriers to adopting new ideas in the service, and whether training could encourage more innovation. But the second stream responded to the bigger and more system-level side to that question of how to go about improving the civil service. That question is big because it's at system level. It's not just about, is this particular management practice good or bad, or should we do more or less of it? But it's about how do we try and make change across dozens of organizations, hundreds of units, thousands or tens of thousands, or even more civil servants all at the same time. After stewing on that question for 4 years, in 2018, I started work on this book, which tackles that question of how to improve bureaucratic performance at the level of an entire system.
As you say, it's a huge question, and it's a very comprehensive book that you have written about it. Is it a question that is being asked around the world by other civil servants?
Absolutely. I would say all the time, everywhere around the world, this is a question that is on the front of mind for policymakers. And sometimes it's at the scale of a full civil service and a full country. Sometimes it's thinking about their organization or their team, but it's really just varieties of that same kind of question. One thing that people outside government, like researchers or donor officials or even citizens, often don't understand is that while they very reasonably express frustration with how well civil services and civil service institutions are often working, I think what they often don't realize is that the most frustrated people with poor performance in civil services are usually the civil servants themselves. They're the ones working hardest to change it.
As you say, you collected evidence for this. How do you collect evidence?
Rather than trying to look for a handful of cases of successful reform or a handful of cases of failed reform, I decided that I was going to look at the universe of performance-oriented system-level reforms that I could find. and try and learn from that. And I wasn't going to do that just in one country. I was going to do that in six countries and look over the last three decades. So I ended up studying system level civil service reform efforts in six countries: Ghana, Kenya, Nigeria, Senegal, South Africa, and Zambia. And looking back over these last three decades, I identified 131 reform efforts that fit this definition. Obviously, there's lots of definitional caveats of what does and doesn't get included in that and count as a reform and so on. But basically, what I tried to do is then for each of these 131 reform efforts, I conducted a really extensive review of existing academic literature, of existing government documents, policy documents, donor reports, media reports. I also interviewed senior elite level civil servants and policymakers and politicians and consultants in each of these countries who are in charge of designing and implementing these reforms. In Ghana and Zambia, I was able to interview the rank and file civil servants who didn't have anything to do with the design of the reforms, often didn't even know that the reforms were happening. But if the reforms were working and trickling down, their day-to-day work would be affected. And so this was a way to assess, are these big, fancy, high-level reforms actually influencing day-to-day practice in any kind of way? And then in Ghana, I was also able, thanks to my partnership with the Office of Head of Civil Service, to read some of the archival records of what were the conversations that were ongoing within Ghana civil service around these reforms at the time, the memos, the draft speeches, and that kind of thing. Based on that combination of evidence, trying to piece together a picture for each of these reforms of what was it trying to do? How did it go about it? To what extent did it get implemented? To what extent, as best we can say, did it actually impact day-to-day behavior and performance? And what were the politics around that reform effort?
So 131 separate reform efforts over more than a generation. Are they consistent? Are they identifying the same problems?
It's a really interesting question. On the one hand, each of these 131 reforms is, of course, unique, right? It came from a specific political moment and set of objectives and set of people and ideas and pressures and so on. But what I found remarkable about it is that almost all of these reform documents identified the same set of problems that they were trying to solve. So they all say, we have this civil service, it's ineffective, it's not delivering value for money. And their diagnosis was also pretty similar, that mainly this is because civil servants aren't motivated, they don't have performance culture, they need to be more responsive and accountable. So you could almost copy and paste these descriptions from one country to another, from one reform effort to another over time. It's not just these six countries, it's not even just low and middle income countries in general. Almost any civil service document or plan anywhere around the world that you pick up starts with some kind of version of this lament about poor performance and lack of motivation and lack of performance culture and saying that these are the things that we need to fix.
The fact that you're still finding reform efforts implies, as we might guess, that the job is not done. But what is the track record of civil service reform when we have these laments?
This was another question that surprised me when I started digging into the data. And it's really a glass half empty, glass half full kind of thing. So the half empty part is that out of the 131 reforms that I looked at, not a single one of them actually achieved all of the goals that it set out for itself. So there wasn't a single reform that was completely, unambiguously, fully successful. Many reforms managed to make changes to the formal rules and processes and structures that were written on paper. But these new rules ended up not being implemented, kind of just like the old rules weren't, or they often fell away in their implementation after a year or two. And so after this big initial push of energy, there ended up not being a lot of substantive change in the day-to-day routines of how people got work done. Having said that, very few reforms were total failures. Almost all of them managed to achieve something. Again, more often on paper than in practice, but in many times in practice as well. And so we have this situation where reforms always fell short of their goals and often encountered pretty severe shortcomings in implementation. But it's not at all the case that reform is impossible or that all these reforms were wastes of time. Lots of them did actually make meaningful impacts, even if not as much as they had hoped or expected.
These civil services continue to operate. Can we think about the cost of a failure to reform, though?
Having an effective public service is absolutely crucial for development, social development, economic development. It's important for political accountability, for access to public services, the fulfillment of people's basic rights. But there's no perfect organization anywhere in the world, and lots of them that exist are very, very imperfect. And so the most obvious cost of reform failure is that inefficiencies persist, money gets wasted, services go undelivered, and lots of policies that look great on paper don't get implemented effectively. But another cost of reform that's less obvious to people outside the government is that every failed reform, every missed opportunity, becomes a source of discouragement to the people working in government who actually do care about doing a good job, or to the people who don't take government jobs because they think the institutions are so dysfunctional that they couldn't make a difference or would be miserable to work in. And so the cost of failed reforms are huge, both in terms of the present cost to society, but also by entrenching cynicism and frustration that can hurt future reform efforts too. It's not so much that public leaders don't want to improve performance. Not all of them are wonderful leaders, but many do. But I think that the issue really is that actually improving performance in big complex bureaucracies is not at all a straightforward thing to do.
It's not a straightforward thing. That's an understatement, I think, Martin, having read your book. I want to talk about what you think could work. But first of all, we have to have the unpleasant business of talking about what doesn't work, what hasn't worked. You point out in the book that most reforms start off by changing rules and creating accountability and incentives. This seems like the obvious idea. This seems like the first thing that anyone would do. Why is it not a good starting point?
So like you said, overwhelmingly, the vast majority of these reform efforts, the way that they envisioned improving performance was creating or changing formal rules and processes and structures. And there are two problems with this approach. The first is that many bureaucracies around the world are already full of formal rules that aren't being implemented or that aren't being implemented correctly. Mm-hmm. And so just changing what's written on paper without addressing implementation doesn't often change what is actually going on the ground. It's also very time consuming. It's very distracting. People spend all their energy debating, like, what is the optimal set of rules to have written on paper? But whether that actually translates through into practice often becomes a secondary consideration or gets left for phase two of reform that shockingly doesn't happen. But the second problem, and I think actually a deeper problem, is that many, many things that civil servants do in their day-to-day jobs that are important for performance aren't the type of things that can be formalized in a job description or standard operating procedure or set of KPIs. Civil servants have to innovate. They have to adapt to changing circumstances. They have to coordinate with others within their team, with other teams in their organization, across organizations, with stakeholders outside of government. They have to go above and beyond the minimum required of them to deliver on the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law. In economics, this is something that often gets referred to through the language of verifiability, mm-hmm. which comes from organizational economics. And the idea is that in any contract or in any employment relation, there are some types of actions that are verifiable that a third party can determine objectively whether the two actors involved did the thing correctly. But many things are non-verifiable, which is to say that a third party like an auditor or a judge or an administrative tribunal couldn't actually tell objectively for sure whether each side performed effectively. And all those non-verifiable tasks, those are all those unformalizable things like innovation, adaptation, coordination that you just can't govern fully through formal processes. You need civil servants to do all these unformalizable things. And the overwhelming focus of reforms on just changing formal rules and processes, creating accountability to force people to do the right thing, that doesn't address whether people are doing those unformalizable things or not. And in many ways, it actually discourages it.
I take your point, but many employment relationships are not based exclusively on a contract. As economists, we often recommend that people in employment should be paid for performance. The same I've seen many times recommended for civil servants. In your experience, does this work?
Yeah, so this idea that the solution to performance problems is to link measured performance to some type of reward or sanction is really, really common all over the world. There's lots of academic studies that are trialing performance incentives and seeing what their impacts on performance are and that kind of thing. It's also a really common belief among policymakers in these six countries that I looked at. Efforts to create performance-linked incentives, either for senior civil servants or for rank-and-file civil servants. Like, that was the most common category of reforms. There were 34 different efforts across these six countries to create performance-linked incentive systems, which, you know, had some type of carrot, some type of stick attached to measured performance. And what was really striking was that in zero out of these 34 cases were differentiated incentives actually delivered on a sustained basis.
Right.
So that's not to say that the incentives didn't have a positive impact. It's to say that differentiated incentives weren't even delivered. There were only two cases actually of even partial sustained delivery of rewards and none of sanctions based on measured performance. Zero out of 34 is not a good success rate for these policies. In the academic literature, we have some selected examples of implementation failure at scale of these types of incentive programs, but I think they often get treated as a kind of aberration or a case of this was implementation failure, which is not the norm. But in fact, when looking at civil services, and at least in these six countries in this time period, incentives not being delivered is the norm. There's actually pretty strong evidence from all around the world that this is the case in most civil services most of the time around the world. So why is this happening? Well, what's interesting is that for each of these different reform efforts, when you read the case studies and the policy documents about them, they each have very idiosyncratic explanations for why that reform didn't succeed. But the common underlying cause, and when you have a success rate of 0 out of 34, I think you have to look for what is the fundamental problem with this approach to reform. The common underlying cause is this importance of unformalizable, non-verifiable actions that I had talked about earlier, that you need civil servants to do things that can't be perfectly formalized in a set of targets or KPIs and can't be objectively measured after the fact. If those things get neglected, but the systems get enforced strictly, then it is really distortionary of behavior. Managers realize that in advance. Either they set very soft targets for themselves and for their staff so that they're sure to achieve them, and then the process just becomes a tick box exercise, or everybody gets the same score at the end of the year, no matter what, because they can't prove for sure who did better and who did worse. And so then again, it becomes a tick box exercise. And so over and over, you see this pattern happening. It just becomes going through the motions. I find this really interesting, this kind of disjuncture between economics research on the one hand, which is very focused on trying to understand the effects of incentives that are actually delivered, often under experimentally controlled conditions, and the literature in public administration and management studies, which is usually based on observation of actual large-scale incentive systems. And in that observational at-scale setting, this type of implementation challenge is really the norm rather than the exception.
It's a great point. You also pick out another misstep that is common: projectization. What does that mean?
This idea of the projectization of reform is referring not so much to what governments are trying to do in making reform, but how they're trying to do it. And overwhelmingly, the how of how they're trying to do it is that they're viewing reform as a kind of one-off intervention, that you have a system that's not working and you make a plan, you intervene to fix a discrete set of problems with a single change that can be, you know, is either a changing a written rule or process, or maybe it's a 3 or 5 year reform plan. And the idea is that we're going to go in, we're going to fix it, and that performance problem is going to be solved. Projectized reforms often are time bound. They often have a predetermined end date and set of activities and outputs. They often have their own budget, their own acronym, their own implementing team. And I think perhaps most importantly, projectizing reform means conceiving of the process of changing behavior as separate from the core processes of actually doing the organization's work. You know, reform is a separate thing. And so in the book, I talk about five different ways that projectization undermines the ability of reforms to achieve the sustained improvements in actual behaviors and performance that they're trying to achieve. So I talk about how it's distortionary of the goals of reform, the content of reform, the implementation and leadership of reform, and the politics around reform. And just to highlight a couple of those, one way of that it's distortionary of goals is that having a projectized approach to reform really reinforces the already existing focus on the content of reform being about changing the formal rules and structures. Because have you changed a law? Have you introduced a new policy? That's something that you can define very clearly ex ante. It's something that at the end of the project, once you have to justify, have you spent all this money and be report on success, you can say, is there a new policy? Yes, there's a new policy. It's a highly verifiable type of change. Whereas things like changing performance culture, the actual implementation of that policy, is that process serving a meaningful purpose? Do civil servants actually find it helpful? These things are much less verifiable. And so they're much harder to report on. They're much harder to be accountable for. And when you have a project that is high profile, that is trying to change things in a time-bound way, there's a real tendency to gravitate then even more so towards formal on-paper changes. In terms of the implementation of reforms, projectization is unhelpful because the focus on reform as a kind of one-off or a time-bound thing undermines the credibility that this reform is going to bring about a sustained change in behavior. Mm-hmm. One of the key lessons, I think, from the book and from the research that myself and co-authors and lots of other people have done is that if you want to get people either to follow, like to implement existing formal rules or to do all these unformalizable things, the key thing is expectations and norms. Do they think that other people are also going to do this? Do they think that they're going to be recognized and acknowledged and rewarded if they go above and beyond? All of those are about expectations about the future and about credibility of the people introducing the reform. And as soon as you introduce a predetermined end date, you're just reinforcing this existing perception that civil servants often have, which is that this is just a song and dance that's going to happen for a couple of years, and then people are going to move on and things will go back to normal. Projectization in all of these ways and more, I think, is really unhelpful for the most meaningful types of performance improvement that we want to see.
Okay, so those are some of the things that really don't work that are often tried. But we're not going to leave it there, are we? We are going to talk about what you consider might work better. And I see in the book that you have three rules of thumb. The first one that you choose is improving the enforcement of existing rules before you create new ones. Is this something where you see an enforcement gap, the existing rules just aren't being applied?
So I would phrase it slightly differently. Rather than focusing on enforcement, I would say first, do what you can to improve performance within the existing set of rules written on paper.
Right, yes. Yeah,
right. And so some of that might be about better enforcement and implementation and compliance of those formal rules. But it might also have to do with focusing on all of those kind of unformalizable things. And these are things that you can do that have a few advantages. First of all, the fact that you're working within the existing formal rules means that you can start change tomorrow. You don't have to wait for a formal legislative process to happen or get formal stakeholder comment or all of these kind of things that can slow change. You're working within the existing rules. You already have legal authorization to apply these rules, to do things that aren't prohibited by them. And so use that flexibility so that you can immediately start change. And that might mean starting small, but that helps then build credibility and build legitimacy and build belief so that as you work up to larger things, then you're able to take on more important things. And eventually, you might have to change formal rules and processes, right? Sometimes those two things do need to be changed. But I think the rule of thumb says, see changing formal rules and processes as a last resort rather than a first step to reform.
Rule of thumb two. I was interested in this because if you read business books, this is very often the opposite of what they recommend. You recommend treating change as a series of small steps. Can you actually motivate staff to change in this way rather than presenting them with a huge goal, a big plan?
I think you can, and I think in practice it actually often works much better. And partly it's about reframing what we think of as the goal of reform. Implicitly, people often have this idea that the goal of reform is we're going to change a few things and get a big one-off improvement. But what characterizes the best performing organizations, whether in the public sector or the private sector, anywhere in the world, is that they have a culture and a norm and a set of processes where change within the organization is an ongoing process of continuous improvement rather than the sort of occasional sporadic reform efforts. Continuous improvement is about finding small things that you can do better. It's about seeing the work of identifying improvements as being the job of everybody in the organization as they're going about their day-to-day work. So it's part of their core responsibilities. It's not the job for someone else sitting off in a reform unit or for the CEO or something like that. Thinking about it as an ongoing process helps reframe how we think about the temporality of change, that a successful change, a successful reform isn't a one-off, we did a thing and we fixed it. It's starting off this ongoing process. The point of an ongoing process also is that it never ends, right? So a good metaphor for this is trying to be more healthy by being in better physical shape. And so to do that, you might start exercising. But if you work really hard for months and months and you exercise and you get in much better physical shape and you get to the point where you want to be and then you stop exercising, then you lose all of those benefits. And continuous improvement, good performance is the same. You can't fix things and then you get there and then you can rest on your laurels. The whole point is that how you get there and how you sustain it is by having this continuous improvement process that is ongoing. The point about starting small within this is not that you stay small forever necessarily. It's that tangible actions that actually change behavior, that actually improve performance, that's what builds credibility. And so starting small is what allows you to get big. So the point is not to be unambitious. The point is to be ambitious. If you're in a situation where it's hard to build credibility, there's a lot of reform fatigue, people are cynical, that the way that you can get ambitious is by starting small and building in this ongoing way.
Rule of thumb 3 is to decentralize the leadership of reform. How does a leader do this in practice?
The dominant understanding of what it means to be a reform leader around the world is that you are coming up with a visionary plan and you're sort of driving it in a top-down way. And you have to bring other people along with you and get compliance with this thing that you're cascading down to.
That's our mental model of it, isn't it?
And it's actually really ineffective. And so in the book, I talk about all these empirical and theoretical reasons why this is not a very good way to actually get people to start doing all those unformalizable things you need them to do. And instead, the mental model that I suggest for leadership is that it's about catalyzing improvement, not forcing. So what is a civil service? It's these tens of thousands of individuals and hundreds of teams across dozens of organizations that are each doing different things. And you want to improve the relationships that those people have to each other such that they can improve the culture of that unit and that they're not only doing the formal things that you need them to, but also going above and beyond and doing all these unformalizable things. Now, if you're someone like a head of civil service who's sitting at the center of all of that, you're not interacting with those people on a day-to-day basis. And so what you need to do is find what things that you can do as a central actor or a leader that help all of those organizations and teams solve their own problems. You kind of have to decentralize some of the leadership to them in terms of deciding what are the most important things to work on, what would be the actions we would need to take to actually improve them and so on. And you find ways to help them escalate problems, to coordinate with each other, to recognize and highlight success, to convey the message to everybody that, hey, we're changing things, we want to improve performance. If you have an idea to improve performance, bring it up and you will receive support and encouragement for that rather than being shouted down because why are you speaking out of turn? I think this idea of reform leadership as a decentralized process of catalyzing rather than forcing has advantages. There's also a sustainability advantage. So often you find that reform leaders feel that they need to force change because they think, oh, I have a short time horizon. You know, there's an election coming up in however many years, or ministers get rotated and I might only have 2 years here. So I have to force all of this change in 2 years and I'm going to try and write everything down so that it persists after I leave. And that's an understandable rationale, but it's actually quite counterproductive in a sense because it guarantees that whatever you do is going to be reversed after you leave. This idea that you need to make things really high profile, that you should personalize it by making it about one visionary champion, that you should bring in high level political support and that kind of thing. Like, yes, it has some short-term advantages, But long term, it guarantees that this change effort is going to be identified with you. As soon as you leave, it loses effort. And the next person who comes in is probably going to do away with it.
But Martin, civil servants have to work with donors and politicians, the sponsors of this change. And they like that vision thing. They like visible results. They are impatient. They can't afford to wait. How can civil servants work with them to achieve the sorts of results using the processes that you recommend?
Yeah, so I think that's absolutely true. But the first thing is that I don't think that this idea of reform as process is about waiting or about being patient. To me, it's actually about the opposite, which is thinking about reform as trying to catalyze an ongoing process of continuous improvement means that you can start the work of reform immediately. And you might start with small things, but that's because you're building. And you might not set out a predefined set of outputs and actions, but that doesn't mean that you're not doing anything. And you need to find ways to demonstrate tangible improvements to people. That's certainly true. But actually, it's often easier and faster to do that by not starting with this dominant mode of let's go about trying to change formal rules and processes and so on. And so some of that is just about communication and framing as well. But I think also one of the reasons why institutional reformers need to appeal to these concerns of donors and politicians is that if they want to spend money on reforms, if they want budget, they need to explain upfront how is that going to be spent. And after they spent it, they need to justify how they've spent it. And so that's actually one of the factors that forces reformers into approaching reform as a project and thus focusing on formal measurable outputs, whether the money that they're seeking is from a donor or from a government budget. But I think one of the lessons of the book is that many of the most meaningful reforms don't require any money because they're about working within the rules. They're about day-to-day things. They're about small ideas that come from inside. They're about changing culture. And indeed, money can even distract or get in the way of doing these important things because it absorbs lots of attention and it distorts what you do. So one of the advantages of finding ways to improve performance that don't require money is that it effectively gains you autonomy by reducing the pressure to measure and prove everything to external stakeholders. I'd say this is also an issue where I think there's an important role for researchers to play. So aside from impatience and accountability pressures, one of the reasons that reformers can fall into the trap of projectized approaches to reform is that they don't think there's any alternative. They don't have evidence on the implementation issues that projectized reforms often encounter. And even if they do want to do things differently, they don't have anything to point to explain to their stakeholders and donors and politicians that this is why they want to do something different and that there's evidence that it can't work. So one of my hopes for this book is that it can help to provide some evidence and inspiration to civil servants who want to approach reform in creative ways. And for the many, many civil servants around the world who do recognize already the problems of the existing way of going about change, that this book can be something that they can point towards to justify why they want to do things differently. And hopefully also encourage more researchers to do this kind of research about designing and implementing systemic reforms and to build on these ideas and test them out and extend them and make them even better.
What clearly comes across from all of this is that reform is hard work. And where we started on this is that very often it's hard work with little or no result. Is there, though, Martin, evidence that reform can work and that there are real gains when it does work?
Yes, absolutely. So much of the book focuses on what hasn't worked. And at the same time, it also documents a lot of what has worked and what does work. And those three rules of thumb that I mentioned earlier, those are based on my observation and my analysis across these 131 reform efforts of what are the things that actually do lead to meaningful and sustained improvements in these day-to-day practices when that does happen. It's also true at the level of system performance as a whole. There have been lots of reforms that have led to meaningful improvements, even if often less than anticipated. And in Ghana, thanks to the micro and meso level data-driven work I mentioned earlier, we can demonstrate that there have been meaningful improvements in management quality and other performance measures in recent years. So even though reform is difficult, it's not hopeless. And there's so much frustration with the status quo that giving civil servants small but meaningful opportunities to improve can be incredibly powerful. I came away from the process of researching and writing this book more optimistic about the prospects for civil service reform than I was when I went into it.
Well, I think many of us, after reading this book, can come out of it optimistic about the prospects for reform. Thank you very much for taking all those years to research and write it, Martin. Thank you very much for talking about it today.
Thank you, Tim.
The book is called Reform as Process, Implementing Change in Public Bureaucracies. Author, you've just heard from him, Martin Williams. It is published by Columbia University Press. And Martin, you are not going to make your fortune out of this. You've made it open access. Why is that?
So it's open access, which means anyone can download a free PDF copy or a free ebook. The reason for that really is that the point of this book is, like you said, not to be sold and to make me money, but to be useful for all the researchers and the policymakers and the people around the world who care about these issues and might find it useful. So please do, if you're interested, download a copy, share it with your colleagues, with your research partners, with anyone who you think might find it interesting.
We'll make sure that all those links are in the show notes for you. Martin, thank you very much. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe, you find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes are at voxdev.org, where there are articles about the topics that we feature. If you have enjoyed this episode, please share it with someone, not just the book, but the episode as well, and leave us a review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.